Osho, The Dhammapada, The Way of the Buddha, Volume 11, Discourse Number 10.
The first question. Bhagwan, to become enlightened, do you need to be Jivis? Or does it just help? Amitabh. Religion has been missing one very fundamental quality, the sense of humor. It has been very unfortunate because it has made religion sick. The sense of humor is part, essential part of the wholeness of man. It keeps him healthy. It keeps him young. It keeps him fresh. And for centuries, the sad people have dominated religion. They have expelled laughter from the churches, from the mosques, from the temples. The day laughter enters back into the holy places, they will be really holy, because they will be whole. Laughter is the only quality that distinguishes man from other animals. Only man can see the ridiculous, the absurd. Only he has the capacity and the consciousness to be aware of the cosmic joke that existence is. It is a cosmic joke. It is not a serious affair. Seriousness is disease, but seriousness has been praised, respected, honored. It was absolutely essential to be serious to be a saint. Hence only pathological people became interested in religion. People who were incapable of laughter. And people who are incapable of laughter are subhuman. They are not yet human yet. What to say about their being divine? That is impossible. They have not yet become human. And to be human is the bridge between the animal and the divine. Hence, I have tremendous respect for the sense of humor, for laughter. Laughter is far more sacred than prayer. Because prayer can be done by any stupid person. It does not require much intelligence. Laughter requires intelligence. It requires presence of mind, a quickness of seeing into things. A joke cannot be explained. Either you understand it or you miss it. If it is explained, it loses the whole point. Hence, no joke can be explained. Either immediately you get it. If you don't get it immediately, then you can try to find out the meaning of it. You will find out the meaning, but the joke will not be there. It was in the immediacy. Humor needs presence, utter presence. It is not a question of analysis. It is a question of insight. Amitabh, as far as humor is concerned, to be a little bit of Jeevis is very good. Everybody should be a little bit Jeevis. For enlightenment, it will prepare the ground. It will make you more alive. Enlightenment is becoming totally alive. Laughter brings life to you. And if you can laugh totally, there are few more things to be understood. In deep laughter, the ego disappears. It is not found at all. You can't have both laughter and the ego. If the ego is there, it will keep you serious. All egoists are serious people. And all serious people are egoists. To be able to laugh, you need to be like a child, egoless. And when you laugh, suddenly laughter is there, you are not. You come back when the laughter is gone. When the laughter is disappearing far away, when it is subsiding, you come back. The ego comes back. But in the very moment of laughter, you have a glimpse of egolessness. There are only two activities in which you can feel egolessness easily. One is laughter, another is dancing. Dancing is a physiological method, a bodily method to feel egolessness. When the dancer is lost in his dance, he is no more. There is only dance. Laughter is a little more subtle than dance. It is a little more inner. But it has also the same fragrance. When you laugh, it has to be a belly laughter. It should not be just superficial. It should not be just polite. It should not be just a mannerism. I have heard one typist was leaving her service. This was her last day in the office, and the boss was telling the old jokes that he has always been telling, and everybody was laughing except the typist. The boss asked, "What is the matter with you? Can't you get the jokes?" She said, "I have got them long before. You have been repeating them 1001 times, but I need not laugh anymore. Anyway, tomorrow I am leaving." These fools are laughing because they have to laugh. You are the boss. So whether the joke is worth laughing or not does not matter. They have to laugh. It is part of their duty. "But I am leaving. What can you do to me? I am not laughing. You cannot make me laugh with all those rotten jokes." If you laugh out of duty or out of a sense of mannerism, out of politeness, then it is not a belly laughter. Then it is just superficial on the circumference. You are managing it. You will not understand what I am saying about laughter then. Laugh so that your whole body, your whole being becomes involved. And suddenly there will be a glimpse. For the moment, the past disappears, the future disappears, the ego disappears, everything disappears. There is only laughter. And in that moment of laughter, you will be able to see the whole existence laughing. Indians don't have the sense of laughter. In India, we don't have any Indian jokes. All the jokes that are told in India are borrowed. There is no such thing as an Indian joke. Indians are serious people, very religious people, holy people. How they can descend to such lower things like joking? They talk about God. They talk about moksha. They talk about nirvana. They can't laugh. These are not laughing matters. You cannot laugh about God. But if you cannot laugh about God, you will never understand God. The Indian statues of Buddha are totally different than the Chinese statues or the Japanese statues of Buddha. You must have noted the difference. The difference is great. The Indian Buddha has a very athletic body. His belly is very small. almost non-existential. He had never a belly laugh. If there is no belly, how can you have a belly laugh? But the Chinese Buddha has a big belly. And not only a belly, even on the statue, you can see ripples of laughter on the belly. Even in marble, you can see he is laughing. The belly is laughing. No Indian will agree with the Chinese statue. He will say, this is not right. Buddha was not like this, with such a big belly. The Chinese Buddha looks like a clown. But I have great respect for the Chinese Buddha. The Chinese Buddha has absorbed a Lao Tzu, Chuang Tzu, Li Tzu. He is pregnant with Lao Tzu. That's why that big belly. Inside his belly, there is Lao Tzu. And you cannot keep Lao Tzu quiet. He must be laughing and kicking and doing things. Hence the ripples on the belly. Lao Tzu has the sense of humor. Maybe because of that, Lao Tzu could not become the founder of a great religion. There exists no religion in his name. Yes, few rare people have followed his path, but there is no organized church. For the simple reason, because Lao Tzu seems so non-serious. He used to ride on a buffalo. Now can't you find a horse? At least a donkey anybody could have offered. But buffalo? And that too, not in a right posture. Sitting backwards. The buffalo is going to that side and he is looking to the other side. He must have created laughter wherever he must have passed. People must have gathered to see the scene. What is happening? And Chuang Tzu far surpassed his master. There has never been such a beautiful man as Chuang Tzu. All that he has said is utterly absurd, ridiculous, but with profound meaning. First you will laugh, and then slowly you will see the point that he is indicating in a very joyful way towards certain truths which can only be indicated in a joyful way. If you are serious, you cannot make people understand the beauty of existence. the celebration of existence. Life is not a tragedy, it is a comedy. It is not tragic, but religious people have depended on the very idea of life being tragic. It is misery, utter misery. What is there to laugh? Hence they attracted the people who are incapable of laughter, of living, of loving. My effort here, Amitabh, is just the opposite. I want you to learn as much from Buddha, as much from Lao Tzu, as much from Krishna, as much from Chuang Tzu. I would like you to absorb all the great experiences that have happened in the past so that a higher synthesis becomes possible. In that higher synthesis, laughter is going to be one of the most essential qualities. With truth, courage, virtue, laughter also has its own place. In that sense, Jews are beautiful people. They have the greatest sense of laughter in the whole world. They are on the one extreme. On the other extreme are the British people. So many letters I have received, angry, that Bhagwan, you don't understand the British. Who cares to understand? And why should I understand the British? For what? Is nothing else left to understand? I have been telling so many jokes about the Italians, but not a single angry letter. They understand that jokes are jokes. If you understand too much, you cannot joke. A little bit of misunderstanding is needed. Now, one of the most British of all the British sannyasins, Prembodhi, has written, "You don't understand the British at all." You simply prove my point. Somebody else has written that, "Bhagwan, this is not right. You say that no British woman is a woman. They are all ladies." I was simply paying respect. And I think it is a well-known fact that nothing should be said against the dead. against the dead you should always show respect. That's what I was doing. Why you are angry about it? I repeat again, it is very difficult, almost impossible to find a British woman. Only ladies are there. All men may not be gentlemen. Men, after all, are men. Boys are boys. And old boys more so. But as far as women are concerned, they carry the culture, the religion. They are the foundation stones. The British woman has a certain face. No other woman has that kind of nose. They all need plastic surgery. Amitabh, the only problem with the Jews is when it comes to the question of price, then they will go on haggling for centuries. Enlightenment will be just in front of them, but they will haggle for the price. So that is the problem, Amitabh. There you have to be aware. A Scot went into a tailor's and asked to see a suit. The Jewish proprietor came back with a nice Harris tweed. "Look at this," he said, "and it is not £50, not even 40, £30, and it is yours." The Scot examined it carefully. "I would not give you £25 for it, not even 20. My price is £18. "Right," said the Jew. "That's the way I like to do business, no haggling." Then there were the two Jews who bumped into each other after 40 years and rushed to the nearest pub to celebrate. "It will be magic to have a drink together after all these years," said one. "Yeah," said the other, "but don't forget, it is your round." The rich widow needed a blood transfusion, so a Jew donor saved her life. She was so grateful, she gave him £100. But after a relapse, she needed another one, and this time gave the donor £50. The third time he saved her life, she had so much Jewish blood in her that she just thanked him very much. The second question. "Bhagwan, I am utterly miserable. How can I get out of my misery?" "Vandan, I have never come across a person who is utterly miserable. you are tolerating it, you are adjusting with it, you are living with it. If it is so bad, one should stop breathing. Why should one go on living? It can't be so bad. Maybe you love to exaggerate. There are people who always like superlatives, who magnify everything. Small miseries, of course, there are. But what big misery you can have? Where you will have it? I cannot conceive any misery that can be so bad that you can call it absolute. Otherwise, one will simply die immediately. So one thing, remember, is stop exaggerating. That is also a way of the ego. The ego is so strange that it wants to exaggerate everything. Even if it is misery, it will magnify it. It will make big fuss about it. There may be nothing much in it. If you go to the roots, you may find a mouse, but you are talking about elephants. And I know you, Vandan. I have never seen you utterly miserable. You look perfectly normal. Unless all normal people are utterly miserable. Just the ego has the habit of magnifying. A boy came running home from the school. He was breathing hard, puffing, perspiring. He told the mother that somehow God saved me. A tiger is following me. A very dangerous tiger, a very ferocious tiger. The mother said, "You stop exaggerating. I have told you a million times not to exaggerate. And again you are doing. Where is that tiger?" The boy showed her from the window a very small dog. Thin, lean, hungry, was standing outside. And the mother said, "This is the tiger. You go upstairs, pray to God, and ask His forgiveness, and never exaggerate again. Enough is enough." So the boy went upstairs. After 5 minutes, he went back to the mother. And the mother said, "Did you pray?" He said, "Yes." I prayed, and do you know what God said? He said, you don't be worried. When for the first time I saw that dog, I myself had thought that it is a ferocious tiger. So nothing to be worried. I myself was deceived. So what about you? And I am so big. Still I thought it is a very dangerous tiger. I was just getting ready to run away. Then I had another look and found, oh no, it is just a dog. And you are a small child. So if you got frightened, it is natural. Misery is not so big as you make. So the first thing is to reduce it to the right proportions. Before you can get out of it, let the tiger disappear. Be very factual. If you really want to transform your life, be factual. You cannot get out of fictions. You can get out of facts. Facts can be tackled, but fictions cannot be tackled. But this is the way of the mind, the way of the ego, to magnify everything. It makes everything look big. And then, of course, you start suffering in a big way. The cause is not so big, but the effect can be very big. It depends on you. Look again. Consider again. Reconsider the whole situation. What it is that you are calling utterly miserable? And then you will find ordinary facts of life. But we don't want to be ordinary. The ego hankers to be extraordinary. Even if it is misery, we would like to be extraordinary. Somebody asked George Bernard Shaw, where would you like when you die to go, to heaven or to hell? He said, wherever it is. That does not matter. What matters is, I want to be the first. Even if it is hell, I want to be the first. I don't want to be second to anybody. And hence I think hell will be better. Because in heaven, Buddha and Jesus and Zarathustra, and there are so many competitors. And I will have to stand in a queue, and that I hate. I am ready to go to hell. I am ready to suffer in hell. But I want to be the first. The ego is always hankering to be the first. It says, my misery is bigger than anybody else. Whatsoever I am bigger, I am special, I am extraordinary. Once a high court judge came to me. His wife used to come to me. I was surprised because the wife always used to say that he is very much against me and he does not want her to listen to me or read my books or go to me and see me. But whenever I visited that city, she was always coming. So I was also surprised. I asked him, "Your wife always says you are very much against me." He said, "Not that I am very much against you. I am simply afraid that my wife is already crazy. And what you are saying, if it gets into her mind, she exaggerates everything. You will create more trouble for me." I asked him, "Why you have come?" He said, "I have just come to say to you that if she says that she has cancer, reduce it to a headache. Don't be bothered about her cancer. I have suffered my whole life. Then I have learned this lesson. She exaggerates." And in fact, that was the case. Every time she used to come, she was talking about cancer. She was telling that she has cancer of the heart and this and that. And the husband said, "She has nothing. Just a hypochondriac." She goes on exaggerating. A hypochondriac died. Before he was dying, his wife asked, "Have you some last words?" He said, "Yes. On my gravestone, write in big letters, 'Now do you believe me or not?'" The first thing for you is to bring things down to the level of reality. It is difficult, Vandan, particularly so for a woman. They live in fancy. When you fall in love, you think you have fallen in love with a Greek god. And by the time the honeymoon is finished, you know he is nothing but a goddamned Greek. Within 7 days, the Greek god is nothing but a goddamned Greek. And again it will happen. Again you will fall in love. And again you will create a great fancy. You will create projections. And all your projections are going to be shattered sooner or later, because reality has no obligation to fulfill your projections. So first bring down your idea of misery to the fact, to the real, and then it is not difficult to get out of it. Then the second thing is to be aware of it. Just be aware of it and you are out of it. Because you can be aware only if you are not it. That is the miracle of awareness. When you observe something, one thing is certain, absolutely certain, that you are not it. The observer is never the observed. The observed is there as an object confronting you. You are the observer. You are the subject. So misery is there. Pain is there. Our pleasure or whatsoever experience is there, you are not it. You are out of it. Two ham actors were moaning about how tough things were in the motion picture business. "I have not had a part for over 10 years. One of the thespian sighed. "That's nothing," the other ham said. "I have not worked since sound pictures came in." "That's really tough." "You bet it is. I wish to hell I could figure some way to get out of this business." "For 40 years, you are not in the business, and you are still figuring out how to get out of it. Just watch these two steps, Vandan. First, bring your misery to the level of reality, and then watch it. Because only reality can be observed. Fictions cannot be observed. You become identified with them. Once the reality is there, it is objective. Watch it. And suddenly, a great realization happens. You are the watcher. You are out of it. You ask me how I can get out of it. Vandan, you are out of it. Right now you are out of it. It is only an illusion that you are in it. If you want to believe, you can go on believing that you are in it. Otherwise, you can snap out of it any moment. Try. Try to snap out of it. Snap your fingers and slap your face and wake up. The third question. Bhagwan, are you against garlic? I have been eating it since my childhood, and I don't think that it stinks. Virago, meditate over this story. Posters set in the pass offices of Park Avenue's most famous physician. "I have got this terrible problem," he explains. "Everything I eat turns to gas. I just had steak and potatoes and it turned to gas." "That could be serious," countered the doctor. "But fortunately," said Foster, "my gas is noiseless and odorless. Can you cure it?" "I'm sure that I will be able to help, but first I am going to fit you with a hearing aid, and then I am going to fix your nose." The fourth question. Bhagwan, recently you mentioned that the spiritual ego is more dangerous than the normal ego. Can you explain? Prem Unmado "All egos are dangerous. Because the ego is a false entity. It does not exist in fact. It is there because you are not aware of who you are. The ego is just like darkness. Darkness has no positive existence of its own. It is only the absence of light. Hence you cannot do anything directly with darkness. If you want to remove darkness, you cannot remove it directly. You will have to bring light in. If you want to bring darkness in, you cannot bring it directly either. You will have to put the light off. Whatsoever you want to do, you will have to do with the light, because the light has existence. Darkness has no existence. And with the non-existential, nothing can be done. The ego is non-existential. It is a non-entity. It is the absence of awareness, of alertness. You are not conscious. Hence the ego prevails. Hence the darkness remains. All egos are dangerous because you are living into something which is not. You are living for something which is not. You are sacrificing that which is for something that which is not. This is the danger. A real life is being sacrificed at the altar of the non-existential ego. You are running after money, after power, after prestige. But in fact, nobody is really interested in power, money, prestige. They are just ways of the ego to exist. If you have more money, you can have more ego. If you have more power, you can have more ego. The basic desire is to expand the ego. But the more your ego becomes strengthened, the more the darkness becomes dense, the less is the possibility of your becoming aware. And without becoming aware, you are missing the whole opportunity of life, a golden opportunity in which God can be realized, in which truth can be lived, a life which can be a constant celebration, an eternal joy, is sacrificed for something absolutely meaningless. Hence remember, all egos are dangerous. But the spiritual ego is the most dangerous. For the simple reason, because all other egos are grass. You can see that the politician is after his ego. You can see even the politician in some moments can see it. It is very grass. How can you avoid seeing it? You are bound to stumble in it. It is like a rock. But the spiritual ego is very subtle. It is like fragrance. You don't stumble. It does not hit you like a rock. You cannot remove it so easily as you can remove a rock. It is a subtle fragrance. The more spiritual you become, the more your ego becomes subtle and subtler. Your ego becomes pious. And when the poison is pious, of course it is more dangerous. Because you think it is nectar. Now the label is nectar. Inside the bottle is the same poison. Hence your sins are more egoistic than your sinners. There is every hope for the sinners. They can reach to God far more easily than your so-called saints. Your saints are living with such egoistic attitudes. They are full of holy cow dung. Rubbish. The man of the world claims that he has so much money, and the religious man claims he has so much virtue. The worldly man claims he has so much power, so much prestige, and your so-called holy man claims he has also power, spiritual power. He tries to show his spiritual power. One such a so-called spiritual man came to see Ramakrishna. Ramakrishna was sitting on the bank of the Ganges in Dakshineshwar, where he used to live. The spiritual man said to Ramakrishna, "I have heard that you are a great saint. If you really are, then come with me and walk on the water. If you can walk on the water, then I can believe that you are spiritual." Ramakrishna laughed. He said, "Can you walk?" The man said, "Yes, I can walk." Ramakrishna asked him, "How much it took you to learn to walk on the water?" The man said, "It took me 18 years of tremendous effort, austerities, tapascharya, fasting, prayers. I lived in a cave in the Himalayas. I sacrificed everything. Then this spiritual power has been given to me." Ramakrishna said, "I am not spiritual. I am a simple man, very ordinary. But one thing I would like to tell you. When I want to go to the other source, the ferryman takes me. Just in one paisa. Your whole 18 years effort is not much more worth than that. You wasted your 18 years. You may be spiritual, but you are a fool. You are utterly stupid. I have never come across such an unintelligent person, wasting 18 years just to walk on water. Then what is the point? Okay, you can walk on water, so what? This is the spiritual ego, which will go sooner or later to exhibit its powers, to prove that I am holier than you. That man had come with that idea to prove to Ramakrishna that I am holier than you, that I am higher than you. It is meaningless. Buddha is not reported to have done any miracle. Mahavira is not reported to have done any miracle. And my own understanding is that all the miracles that are talked in the name of Jesus are inventions. You see, some Christian got mad. They are all inventions of the Christians. I have a totally different approach. When Christians say Jesus turned water into wine, it is not a literally factual thing. It simply means that people like Jesus get drunk on simple waters. I know it from my own experience. I never mix my soda with whiskey. I mix my soda with soda. And I get drunk. So what is the point of mixing it with whiskey? Just pure air is enough to get drunk. Water is enough. It all carries the essence of God. What more you need to get drunk? This existence is more than is needed. But the spiritual man will try to prove in some way that he is spiritual. He will prove through miracles. He will become an exhibitionist. That's why the spiritual ego is more dangerous. He will not be able to see it, and others will not be able to see it either. Because you cannot see it easily, hence I called it Unmado. It is more dangerous. Drop the very idea that you are separate from existence. And I am not telling you to fight with the ego. That is nonsense. I am telling you to create more awareness in you. Become more full of light and consciousness, and the ego will disappear on its own. And when it disappears on its own, it has a beauty. It has a benediction. When there is no ego in you, no ego, worldly or otherworldly, when there is no ego at all of any kind, you are one with God. The barrier is removed. The last barrier has fallen. And to experience God is to experience life in its utter simplicity, in its utter beauty. To experience God is to experience truth in its eternity. Then you are beyond death and beyond time. Ego is the only barrier, but don't fight with it. Spiritual or worldly, it is the same. You create more consciousness. You be more meditative. Meditation is the only medicine. Both the words come from the same root. Meditation and medicine. Because meditation also is a medicine. It heals you. It cures you from the greatest disease, the disease of the ego. The fifth question. Bhagwan, will you one day go in the middle of the discourse to the kitchen to inquire what is being prepared for you? Pantha, sorry, I cannot do that for many reasons. One is, I am not Ramakrishna. I am just myself. I am nobody else. Secondly, all my kitchen people are here. Vivek is here, Astha is here, Nirgun is here, Pragya is here. There is nobody to inquire. Thirdly, I eat the same food morning, evening, year in, year out. In fact, all my kitchen people are bored by preparing it. Except me, everybody is bored. This is a device to bore them. Just think, the same thing they have to prepare morning, evening, every day. Unless they become enlightened, they are going to go crazy. So there is nothing to ask, I already know. There is no change ever in my food. Thirdly, I don't know where my kitchen is. So, Pantha, even if I want, I cannot find. I know only my room and the way from the room to the Buddha hall and back. I will get lost into Lausu house. And after many, many lives, somehow I have found the way. Please don't make me get lost again. The sixth question, Bhagwan, what is the dirtiest four-letter word in the Indian language? Darshan, work. the sixth question. Bhagwan, you did not finish the story of the priest and his Sunday sermon. Is it not so? Chetan Hari, that is true. Knowingly, I did not finish it. But now that you have asked, I have to finish it. When the priest saw the hell, so beautiful, so ecstatic people, he was certainly became infatuated. He knew all the ways how to reach to heaven. He had no idea how to go to hell. And now seeing hell, he wanted to go to hell, not to heaven. So he inquired a few people. They said, better you ask the Buddha. He is there sitting under the tree. He went to the Buddha and he asked, sir, can you show me the way how to come to the hell? Because now I don't want to see heaven again. Once is enough. And I don't want to go there at all. I have lived my whole life preparing for heaven. I know all the ways and all the methods and means how to reach there. I don't know how to come to hell. Buddha said, you go back to the station and buy a ticket to Pune and take sannyas. That is the best and shortest way to go to hell. The priest is here. Please don't ask me his name. Because priests are a little shy people. And he will feel embarrassed. Particularly a Catholic priest. But he is here. If you try a little hard, you will find him. The eighth question. Bhagwan. Okay. Give it to me straight. Can God really exist in America? Leaving tomorrow, I get a little nervous, realizing how serious the world tends to be. And well, you know, God too. So would you give me one of your fuddy-duddy jokes to share with him, just in case we meet? Toshin, you forget this word, him. God is not a he. God is a she. If you go with this idea that he is a he, you will never find him. That's how people go on missing him. They go on looking for him as if he is a man. And he has changed himself long before. Colonel Sanford, a staunch segregationist, died and somehow made his way to heaven. A week later, his friend Colonel Beauregard departed and was also allowed to get past the pearly gates. The two of them met. never had any doubt we would make it, said Colonel Beauregard. But now that we did, tell me, how are things up here? Not bad, answered Colonel Stanford. But I would advise you to watch your step. I saw God the other day, and she's a nigra. And not only that, he is a sea, she is a nigra, a black woman. So if you are really in search of God in America, remember this. And then you will have to learn a few things. If you meet a black woman, you will have to learn some art. You will have to learn to be a little like a black man. Otherwise, there will be no communication, no communion. God has changed. He was tired of being male and white. Everybody gets tired of being the same. And people are still thinking that he is the old. You are worshipping old photographs. You are carrying old albums. No wonder very few people find him. Now think of God as a woman. And God can only be a woman. The very idea of God being a man is the male chauvinist idea. It is the idea of men. The Christian Trinity has not a single woman in it. Look at the nonsense. They have made even a place for Holy Ghost. Now who is this Holy Ghost? The Trinity would not have missed much if there was no Holy Ghost. But the Trinity looks a little ugly without a woman. The Father is there, the Son is there, and where is the Mother? Do you think God is gay? This is man's egoistic projection. Remember, the sea contains he, but the he does not contain sea. The man is born out of a woman, but no man can give birth to a woman. It is natural to think of God as woman, as mother, not as father. It is a fascist idea. It is not accidental that Germans call their country fatherland. Nobody calls their country fatherland. Everybody calls his country motherland. That seems to be right. Except the Germans. They call it fatherland. God is a mother. A motherly phenomenon. This whole existence is motherly. And God is far more softer than man can ever be. far more vulnerable, far more open. God is the womb of existence. The whole existence comes out of the womb. So Thosen, drop this idea of he and him. Think of she and her. And remember, he is tired of being white. He is no more white. He is black now. And he is enjoying being black. Because very few people are able to find him now. Even if he comes across, you think it is just a nigger. Even if he knocks on your doors, you will not open the doors. And if you meet him, you are asking me that you would like to tell him some joke. Tell him this joke. What makes you black men such good lovers? Ask the white employer of Kinney, the chauffeur. The trouble with you white fox is that you just go in there and rush, and before you know it is all over. Said Kinney, now the way us black fox do it is get in there, take it easy. Make long strokes, talk sweet a while, stop a while, take our time, then some more slow long strokes, nice and cool like. That night, Whitey climbed into bed with his wife and began making love to her exactly as Kinney had suggested. After 20 minutes of sheer delight, she gasped, my God, where did you learn to screw like a black man? Enough for today.